7:59.
Oh.
Wait,
Oh yeah, we're still early. How about that?
Ginger, oh.
Roll call, please.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
I have the pledge of allegiance. Pledge of allegiance to the flag of the States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, God, indivisible, for all. We have approval of the previous minutes.
So moved?
Second, all in favor?
Second, aye.
Okay, that would be, sorry, Debbie.
Gotta get used to the mute on mute.
The financial report, please, Bill.
Great, thank you, commissioners. Good morning, everyone. I believe David is pulling that up now. Perfect, thank you, David. These are the results through the end of February for this meeting. Back this, David, it seems like we're, there it goes, it's blinking. Beautiful. Okay. We see that we are still waiting to catch up a little bit on our property taxes. It looks like our March settlement statement was about $1 million higher, is going to be about $1 million higher than what it was last year. So I think we're going to make up $1 million out of that 1.5 that we're down from a timing perspective. But again, as we talked about last meeting, according to the county, this is all timing related. So we do expect that to catch up. On the charges for services side, out of this $1.2 million behind where we were last year, $1 million of that is at the zoo. We'll talk about specifically what that means. A couple of interesting components there that we touched on last meeting as well. And then from an overall perspective, you can see that the revenue is down about $2 million from where we were through February of last year. We are still seeing benefit of participation in the Shared Work Ohio program when we look at our compensation expense and the fact that we've been pretty cautious and deliberate about the timing of when we are looking at open positions and filling those, as well as the timing of our seasonal starts as we continue to evaluate the environment for what we're going to be able to open for the course of the summer. On the contractual services side, we're still seeing, as we changed our insurance brokers last year, so came a change in timing of our insurance premium payments. So that's what largely this difference is here, the majority of it. There is also about 50,000 of this delta of this 482 is related to the timing on our IT maintenance contracts. And then from an operational standpoint, you can also see we're less spend than last year as well by the $663,000. And this is, again, this is across all kinds of line items as we talked about at the last meeting, and I can go into those into detail if there's some questions. But from an overall perspective, this puts our operating surplus at about $112,000 greater than it was last year. Now, what we're going to see coming up is it's going to be difficult to compare year over year after this point, because now this month, March, we had our shutdown that started on March 17th of last year, went all the way through June 14th. So we're going to see our spend this year all higher than where it was last year because we're open to a large degree. And we're also going to see opportunities, hopefully weather permitting, for revenue to be higher in some cases, particularly at the zoo. So we're gonna have a lot of variances that we're gonna be seeing month over month as we get into March, April, May, June. From a net perspective after capital, you can see that we are about $2.3 million behind on our surplus from where we were last year. And again, we've had a lot of construction going on this year from a timing perspective relative to the projects that were going on at this point last year. Looking specifically at the zoo, so general admission side, again, as a reminder, about $485,000 out of this $551,000 shortfall was the timing of the payment for our partner at Wild Winter Lights. So that is now completely trued up, and the revenue share is good on that. So we won't be seeing that big negative come through going forward. And then on the Zoo Society side, this negative here is due strictly to the timing and the change on our operating agreement. There's actually positive news with the Zoo Society. So last year, to help with the pandemic, the Zoo Society was paying us in monthly increments. When we renewed the agreement, we went to quarterly payments. So the payment that we got in January, February this year, the first payment that we got relative to last year was actually just for December of last year rather than a whole quarter. And so what'll happen is when we get our April payments, we'll get more caught up because that'll be a full quarter payment. The exciting news is CZS is actually about $150,000 ahead of where they were through February of 2019 on their memberships, which was their record year of 2019. So contrary to where we thought we might see a dip because of that extension that we gave on membership renewals for the shutdown period, we're actually ahead of where we were from their best year perspective a couple of years back. So this is truly a timing difference from what we're seeing so far. And then you can see from an overall perspective, that puts us down about $1,013,000 from where we were through February of last year. When we jump down to the operating expenses, we've spent about $538,000 less. So that offset a decent portion of the $1 million shortfall in revenue. And it puts our operating subsidy at about $476,000 greater than where it was through February of last year. And then as we jump down to the net subsidy after capital improvements, capital expenditures, we are about $267,000 more subsidy than where we were on a net perspective versus February of 2020. Jumping over to golf, we had a particularly snowy month in February of this year. There was snow on the ground quite a bit. So you can see for the month, we were down about $39,000 of revenue versus February of 20. It puts us down about $53,000 overall. So to put this in perspective, you know, if weather permits and we have nice opportunities as we have had in March, I would suspect as long as the second half of March is as favorable as the first, we can make up some ground here with some of the play. And then when we look at the expenditure side, total operating expenditures really comparable to where it was at this point last year. We're about $9,600 less spend on the operating side right now. So that takes the operating subsidy to about $43,000 more subsidy at this point this year than it was at last year. And again, we trend on the subsidy side for the first quarter of the year. We start to get towards break even second quarter, third quarter, we typically flip to break even or better. And then from the net perspective after capital expenditures, we're about $31,000 more subsidy at this point in golf than we were last year. Jumping over to enterprise, golf by location. Not a ton to really show because we're so early in the season, but this just gives a quick perspective relative to where we were. Again, as a reminder, yellow means of our two key indicators, revenue and surplus, one of those two indicators, not both, is better than last year. And where it's red means both indicators, revenue or surplus, are behind where they were last year. If we had green, it would mean that both were ahead of where they were last year. Jumping to enterprise, our revenue for the year so far, first 2 months, is actually up $167,000 over where it was last year. We have a wait list at our docks. You can see the dock rental, and this was timing, as we've talked about before, where we are ahead about $67,000 just for the month of February. On the concession side, we'll see that Merwin's has just been doing really, really well, all things considered, even with the fact that we don't have full dining inside. So that's a real nice story there, and it shows some of the demand from the public for when we are going to be able to open that up a little bit. But for the month, we were ahead 36,000. We're about 167,000 ahead for the year. When we look at the operating expenditures, we have spent about $28,000 more in OPEX than we did prior year, and a lot of that is to support the additional $167,000 of revenue. So you have to have inventory to be able to generate those sales.
May I interrupt?
Sure.
Going back to the concessions, because it's higher, why?
Because Merwin's is doing really well.
Why?
Well, it's interesting. We typically, this is a very slow time of year for right. Merwin's. Even when it was open last year, we're just seeing demand. People like the Igloo concept. We had some trailing that came through in January from the success of Riverfest, which we hadn't done Riverfest in the past. So having the ice rink and the beer stand and the grab and go food and the igloos combined on there, was also really strong.
So these are all really operational changes that we've made in response to COVID that are playing forward.
Yes, it's 100% in response to COVID. We were trying to be creative in how we
will probably stay around.
That's what yes. I'm. Yeah, that's yeah. Where I was going with it. Interesting.
So it has been really interesting, and it's encouraging to show that there is an appetite for people to get out and enjoy the experience once we can fully open safely.
So once we adapted, we found something better. Wow.
So, you know, what'll be interesting, Bruce, is it certainly seems to be better during our slow months We'll have to be creative during our busy months when normally we would be full inside and outside. Obviously, if we can't have the inside part, that might start to affect us a little bit as we get into the summer season. So we'll keep an eye on that as we go.
And do we have any sense of like a change in quote unquote competition? In other words, so many businesses adversely impacted. Seems like in many areas, certain types of restaurants have been able to adapt in similar fashion, whereas others. Do we have any overall perception of a market change in terms of market share? Probably too soon, but I'm wondering if that's something.
Too soon and it's probably too small too. It's
yeah.
Sort of hard to.
Oh, okay.
But I think the creativity is the amazing thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how are you going to handle the allocation of the docks this summer in front of Merlot? First come, first serve, or do you reserve?
Yeah, we're going to try first come, first serve for now to see how that works out. There's a couple, you know, is a floating parking lot, is it reserved days in advance? You know, we're looking at the lakefront. There's still capacity for the transient dockage, overnight stays and things like that, whether it be at the yacht clubs or at our own marinas. So we don't know if there will be that demand actually on the river itself. So the floating parking lot concept is kind of what we're looking for. Come on in if it's open, pay to stay type of thing while you're there.
Yeah, okay.
Any questions? And you know, anecdotally too, just judging by some of the traffic patterns, I think there are more and more people coming on premises to work. And obviously if there's more people that are coming downtown, that brings a little bit more to the area as well. And to your point about what's actually open, that may play into it too. So there's a lot of variables right now that are tough to quantify, but
that's kind of what
resulting well.
Thanks.
Okay, and then after the capital perspective, we are about $156,000 ahead on the surplus side of where we were through the first 2 months of 2020. And then here's where you can see Merwin's Wharf, just from the revenue perspective, Bruce, $267,000 in revenue through February versus $84,000 last year. And again, we were open January and February last year. That was pre-close for COVID. So that just shows that the typical winter months for us are not strong, and we've had good performance there with the creativity. You can see the East 55th Marina and Emerald Necklace Marina and Wild Marina. Each of those are ahead of where they were last year. We are now fully implemented in the contract system at all locations. So we eliminated the timing differences that we've seen in the past. And then when we look at Emerald Necklace Restaurant, it's just getting rolling. We started with the fish fries and some small activity out there. So that one we'll keep an eye on and see what happens there, but it's really early in its stages, and then everywhere else still remains closed. And then we go to some of our other locations and we can see.
Can I go back to that sure. Previous slide? So how many of those, like 55th Street rerun internally, right?
Yes.
And Wildwood and Emerald Necklace as well?
Yes. Okay. These are our self-operated marinas. That's correct.
Okay, so the ones we don't run, one would be the one at Wendy Park.
Whiskey Island Marina, we do not run, and we do not run with Edgewater Marina.
Lakeside.
Well, that's Yacht Club.
The Lakeside's a Yacht Club, Forest City Yacht Club, Inner City Yacht Club.
But those are independent.
That's right. Right. That's right. Yeah, right. The only two are Whiskey Island Marina and Edgewater.
And so the Edgewater, that sort of bar and that bar operation is run by someone else.
Yes.
I mean, okay. Why is that? I mean, is that, Joe, is that something we could manage?
Or? Well, Edgewater Marina doesn't have a bar service.
So Edgewater doesn't have a restaurant. So correct. The only restaurant we don't manage is the one at
Whiskey Island.
Okay, I see.
Yep. And we actually did just receive the financial statements from the owner operator of that facility as well.
Okay.
So yeah. And they from a memory perspective, I will tell you, they managed their costs pretty well on a consolidated basis for all the areas that they manage. Their net income was up just slightly from where it was in 2019. By location, they had some variance up and down, but overall they seemed to manage it fairly consistently by contracting where they needed to offset the contracted revenue.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Sure. Interestingly, this also supports anecdotally, there's a little bit more activity downtown as our parking facilities are doing better than they did the first couple of months of 20, as we can see here. And then the chalet did not perform as well. And again, we had restrictions on capacity because we wanted to ensure safe distances. So that was self-imposed that we slowed down a little bit of the volume that was going through there for the season. And that is the update, unless there are any questions.
No, I think we're good. Thank you.
Take the CEO report, Joe. Are you going to stand?
No, Brian should be able to handle that.
Good, very good. Brian, you're on.
All right, thank you so much. Joe's there to he's for color commentary if he needs to fill things in. So it's always a little bit of a lag. But again, thank you to Bill and his team for putting together the financial report. And I think just to highlight from the chalet, even with reduced capacity, we're still in a net positive way. And Bruce, to your point on Merwin's, there have been positives out of COVID. And, you know, there's certainly ways that we've looked at operating our business. And anecdotally, we know that other restaurants are starting to gear up. Employees are starting to move a little bit more. So those are all things that are happening at this point in time. So we will move into the first action item. If we can move the slide down, the first action item is budget adjustment number 3. Bill.
Thank you, Brian. This budget adjustment is for $820,252. It's $114,000 worth of unbudgeted additional revenue from Winterfest. It's $126,500 of restricted funds that were previously unappropriated but received, and $579,000 worth of new restricted funds and donations that have been committed or received since we did the budget. And an explanation of these adjustments by category are on pages 39 to 41 of the agenda. And the recommendation is that the commissioners approve this budget adjustment number 3 for the total of $820,252.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item falls on the bottom portion of page 10. It's for an increase for the Agile Network Telecommunications for Edgewater Beach House. We have worked with Agile since 2016. We have gone through, candidly, a number of different iterations with the triathlon and different large-scale events to actually look at service. We looked at other types of service. It is found that Agile is the only one that can perform and provide. So we are asking for a revised total award of $79,680 for the telecommunications network at Edgewater Beach House. It is on the bottom part of page 10.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
The next action item is the Andean Bear Conservation Alliance contract extension. I guess Chris has some slides for this. This is an important part of what Cleveland Metro Parks does, and with our entire conservation team and our different liaisons. And I would love for Chris to pull that up. Chris?
Trying to figure out where the clicker is.
Sean didn't touch it yet.
All right. Good morning, commissioners. When we talk about our conservation programs, this is a program that we haven't talked about a lot, but this is one of the programs that I like the most because it is a program that really is a lot about Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. Oh boy, I already pushed the wrong button. There we go. So first of all, let's start with why Andean bear. It is an interesting species for us. It is the only bear species in South America. It is the last of the short-faced bears. So it's a unique species biologically. But when you think about megafauna, which we talk a lot about diversity, but really it's the megafauna that get people really interested in conservation and in actions. There aren't a lot of big species in Central and South America. So as a bear species in South America, it has a lot of potential impact. It is a unique species. And it also has a lot of history in terms of public consciousness. It is actually the inspiration behind Paddington Bear. So it's got some really unique characteristics. But for us, it's really unique because of the habitat that it occupies. So I actually have a connection to the Andean bear. I was actually in Venezuela. We've had a connection to Andean bear, spectacle bear research for a really long time. I was in Venezuela as a student here in the mid-90s. And when we were talking to field researchers at the time, there had been people who had been working on Andean bear for 10 years and never actually seen one.
Wow.
They're very secretive. They cover huge ranges. You can see the particular habitat they have is extremely rugged. They're bears that live almost exclusively in the trees. They rarely come to the ground, unlike grizzly and black bears that familiar with. So the research is being done based off of, you know, a lot of indicators, nesting sites, scratch marks, things like that. And it covers a huge geographic range. So our formal relationship with Andean bear, our first funding of Andean bear research began in 2000, even though we had some connections into the 90s. But the geographic range of the species goes through the entire Andean corridor. So there's 5 different countries working on Andean bear. They all had a different methodology. As I mentioned, it's an elusive species. It's hard to manage. So we began building this partnership over time. And in 2006, it was our formal support to Isak Goldstein and the Wildlife Conservation Society to really start to build a collaboration around Andean bear. The Andean Bear Conservation Alliance, which we refer to as ABCO, was actually started in 2010 in partnership with the Wildlife Conservation Society. And over a period of time, what that partnership that became ABCO grew to the point where Cleveland Metro Park Zoo has really become ABCO. We've really taken on, and we spent a lot of time working with Rose and her team, really working on how do we manage this program and how do we grow it.
Chris, how far north does it go?
Into southern Venezuela.
Southern Venezuela.
There we go. So when you talk about a strategy, I'm going to show a couple of slides here to talk about sort of what the strategy has been and how we're achieving it. But I want you to think about this in terms of what can Clevelanders, what can we based in Northeast Ohio do to really develop this program? We're not in Venezuela. We're not in Colombia or Peru. What can we provide? And what we recognized early on with ABCA is that there was a need for some consistent training, some consistent monitoring, some capacity building, really combining the efforts of all these individual countries and all these different park districts within the same country and get them sort of standardized so everybody was approaching the conservation of Andean bears in the same way. So what we've really been building over time is training, capacity building for people on the ground doing Andean bear research. We're not going in as Northeast Ohioans telling people in Peru how they should conserve Andean bear. What we're doing is we're providing the tools, monitoring programs, training, help with conservation management plans to really coordinate all the people that are on the ground living with the species to be able to have the greatest impact. And as I mentioned, here's a map of the actual geographic range. You know, like I said, the southern Venezuela is actually where I was in the habitat. That's where the northernmost connection to the species. The heart of the habitat is really in Colombia and Peru, but there are some fragmented habitats further south. What we're really trying to build here again is developing tools, providing training, really helping build the programs and an effective conservation plan. And when you notice the people that are doing the research, there's no Americans there. And this collaboration is really driven by the gentleman who's on the far right of that that picture right there, and that is Robert Marquez. Robert is the coordinator for Andean Bear Conservation Alliance. We have supported Robert for the past couple of years as a contractor, helping really drive this program forward. Kim Gopp, who is the zoo's conservation curator, functions as the director of the Andean Bear Conservation Alliance. And this alliance includes multiple countries throughout the habitat, park districts, and then multiple zoos now. We were recently at the Nashville Zoo. They just opened a big Andean bear. They've joined us and followed our lead in supporting Andean bear conservation. And it's really Robert who's coordinating in country and really driving these training processes. What we're trying to do is, again, gather these data, but the most important thing that's come through, and the reason why this action item is in front of you, is because what we're trying to do is align Robert's contract with our operating agreement with the National Park System in Peru. So that's a 5-year contract. We've been supporting Robert in small dollar amounts, $28,000 a year for the past couple of years. When you try to put together a 5-year contract, now we're talking about a total compensation package that requires board action. But these are some of the achievements that we've had with these species over the past 10 years. You know, the things that I'm most proud of is the fact that we're really working through programs in 16 different landscapes, 200 different stakeholders, multiple graduate students, all being coordinated, not run by, but coordinating through our leadership to be able to get the right people in the right place and try to get those resources in the right place.
What ultimately is a deliverable that you see on the horizon?
So what you're seeing is more and more habitat being actually protected. Okay. We're seeing now, as we get better methodology in place and we standardize the methodology so we can truly determine how many bears are in the habitat, because we haven't been able to know that. Mm-hmm. First step is how many bears are there?
So it's
and then extended monitoring to determine whether or not these protective measures are actually increasing that number, or whether fragmentation and human impacts in that habitat is driving that number down. We're also seeing additional training. So the number of local professionals that are getting involved in Andean bear conservation or secondary conservation initiatives in those countries that are coming out of the program, that's also another deliverable out of the program.
But do we have some sense, like maybe in 5 years, there'll be a collection, sufficient collection of all these data that a report, we get some kind of a profile of all?
Yeah, I think we're well on the way to getting that. Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yep.
Chris, is the population in captivity stable?
Stable is a strong word, unfortunately. So there are two bear species that, so let me back up. A lot of the North American species, we don't breed because we're able to take in orphan cubs with grizzlies and black bears. We don't actually actively breed those species. The two species that we breed in AZA facilities are sloth bears, which are an Indian species, and Andean bear, which is what we're talking about now. Both of those species are species that we are looking at, you know, in long term, really expanding our habitat. That's going to be a capital project that we're going to be bringing forward here in the next few months. But really, this is a species that needs work in zoos in the US. We really need to continue to focus on the correct spaces to be able to breed these species. So it's not a dead end species, but it's not in great shape like gorilla or some other taxa.
They do breed in captivity though, right?
They do, yes.
Chris, what is the number one threat to the Andean bear? Is it loss of habitat? Is it humans, or what's happening?
You don't know.
I think it's habitat largely, but it's also probably some minor human impact. It's really a habitat issue, as some of this habitat's being cut down for terraced farming, human impacts. What we really don't know, because the species is so widespread and so elusive, is what's the status of the population today, right? And that's the biggest issue. We know that there's not a lot of them. We don't know whether the remaining is enough. Do we need expanded habitat, or if we just protect this habitat, is that what we need? So that's the big question.
Wow.
So just to summarize here, I'll turn it back to Brian here, but the Conservation Alliance is largely driven by Kim Gopp as the ABCA director, and she's our curator of conservation. Isak Goldstein was originally the coordinator in this project. Isak has now retired, but he still serves as an advisor to the program. And really the boots on the ground, rope sleeves, get the work done in Colombia is Robert. So the action item, the information there is listed. We think this is a great program, and Robert's actually been in the United States multiple times over the past couple of years, presented to our teams, which really helps develop capacity for our staff on top of what we're providing for ABCA. So unless there's any questions, Brian, I'll leave it to you.
Thank you.
That was a fantastic update. And I think it's really important, you know, the things that we're able to highlight and the work that the Cleveland Metro Parks Zoo is doing globally is extremely impressive. So the recommended action item, this is a 5-year contract to enter into, and it is on the top portion of page 12 to enter into the agreement for the Andean bear conservation.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Chris, one more question. Is this bear interfertile with any of the more northern bears?
Is the bear what with
interfertile? Is it?
I don't know. I don't know. They certainly do not overlap habitat. And
right, yeah.
I mean, it's thousands of miles between habitats, so I don't know. It's not something that we've attempted. It is a separate genus, and it is more of a primitive lineage than what we see here, what we consider long-nosed bears as opposed to the short-faced bears that these are. So I don't know, maybe, but maybe not.
It's an interesting shape.
It is, you know, it's a different sort of head shape, body shape. It's a smaller species. And that's what you tend to see in more tropical bears. We think of bears as being more temperate and cold weather, but there are these tropical bears that we've highlighted here over the years, sun bears, sloth bears, and these Andean bears.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Yeah.
As you heard from Chris, you've got to find him first, Commissioner. The next action item we'll move to is action item D, authorization of land acquisition. This is the Lindsay property. This is in Big Creek. It's about an acre and a half. This is a property that sits off of Eastland Road in Middleburg Heights. This is another great example of connections, conductivity, and preservation. This is something that we've been working on for a number of years with Byers Pond, the connection over to Big Creek, and ultimately, hopefully, back over to Millstream Run Reservation. This is a property that we had looked at before. We had passed on it for a number of times, but this is an opportunity now to preserve this corner of property here. We are actually partnering with the City of Middleburg Heights, Mayor Castelli's group. We're working with the Cuyahoga County Board of Health on a cleanup of this entire property. City of Middleburg Heights has agreed for to pay for the demolition, and this will be a corner property of Cleveland Metro Parks off of Main and Eastland Road. And it's a great opportunity to showcase the connections between the multiple lakes and the multiple reservations. So we look forward to bringing this recommended action. If there are no questions on the property acquisition, on the top portion of page 13 to buy the 1.4 acre property in Big Creek.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item is a continuation of Police Chief Dolan's work. This is the authorization for Cleveland Metro Parks Police Department to enter into an intergovernmental cooperative mutual aid agreement. This is with the cities of Independence, Lyndhurst, and Broadview Heights. These continue to pay dividends, not only the interagency intergovernmental cooperative agreements, but also our new dispatch center. So the recommended action to enter into these intergovernmental cooperative mutual aid agreements falls in the mid portion of page 13.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We will move into the next action item for the contract amendment for the zoo zip line at the Cleveland Metro Parks Zoo. This is the GMP2. Site clearing and a whole bunch of work is already well into progress. The pieces of equipment are being fabricated. This is to do all of the temporary facilities, the walkway installation, the electrical, the roofing. We've done work on the lake currently. We're looking at the labor to install, Wade Hall renovation allowance. So this is a culmination of a lot of different opportunity costs to bring together the zip line at the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. We are still on schedule based on current conditions. And the recommended action, if there aren't any questions, are on the top portion of page 15 to enter into the GMP2 with Regency Construction for the services of the zip line at the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo.
What is that schedule? Can you just remind us?
End of
if
summer.
Sean is, yeah, it'll be in this summer. Footers are coming in next, and we'll be continuing to move forward. I actually don't have the current schedule, but I can certainly get it out to you. It's March, and the goal is by, you know, first part of early summer.
Oh, good. Great. Thank you.
One more question, Brian. What will this make? What does it look like the total cost might be on this with this?
I believe we're in the about 1.6 range.
1.6.
I'm just talking.
Okay. Thank you.
Sean, anything you'd like to add? I know you're definitely itching to talk.
Early summer. Yeah.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. To confirm Brian's statement, total project budget is approximately 1.6 million. So you see here, what Regency will be bringing is just over 1 million, and then the balance of it is from the vendor bringing the actual zipline equipment.
Okay.
And our goal here is to get done as soon as possible in the either very early summer or even before that. So that is
awesome.
Terrific. Wonderful.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Again, just to, as we move into the next action item, this is also being supported through philanthropic support through the Cleveland Zoological Society. So again, this is a partnership where we can add value to the zoo. The next action item is the resolution of support and approval of the Cuyahoga County Greenways Plan. This has been a work dating back quite a number of years already. And I know Sarah's in the boardroom now to give the presentation. But the reason, quite honestly, that I really wanted to bring this forward as an update and support and commitment is really showing the strength and unification between the work that NOAACA and tremendous amount of different communities have put together work to bring this forward. And as we become aligned, funding strategies and funding priorities and priorities for trails should be widely recognized, that the work of this should be dictated on how we continue to move forward. And I thought it was very important for our regional form of government to bring this forward in a fashion that we've adopted it and embraced it, and then work to figure out kind of the next steps. And so Sarah is going to give us a breakdown of the countywide initiative, and then be asking for support to bring this to an action item. Sarah?
Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you. As Brian said, we've talked about this project for multiple years, and then the plan's actually been completed for a couple of years now, and we've been using it. But it's important to really, as Brian said, embrace it. And so that's why we're asking you to adopt it today. We are using this in a lot of our planning work. As you might recall, the Cuyahoga Greenways plan is a countywide vision, 50-year vision for building out the trails and greenways network within the county. And it incorporates prior Transportation for Livable Communities initiative planning studies and kind of coalesces them into one overarching plan so that municipalities, other governmental entities can all see that this is what people have agreed to are the major corridors, the major connection points to be able to build off of that and to collaborate on projects.
Sarah, what does no stress, low stress mean?
Oh, low stress, sorry. The vision, I should read that, a completed countywide network of off-road trails and on-road low-stress pedestrian bicycle facilities accessible for persons of all ages and abilities for transportation, exercise, and enjoyment. And low stress just means that there's actually a level of traffic stress analysis that's done for different bike facilities. So if you have an off-road trail, that's going to be the lowest stress because you're separated from traffic. If you're on a busy road and it's just sharrows that are on the road, that's going to be a higher stress because of the volume of traffic, the speed of traffic.
I understand. Thank you.
So, and also the lower the traffic stress, usually you have more ridership. It's open to a wider range of people that might be taking their children with them on a ride. So with the Cuyahoga Greenways plan, that it was in development from 2017 to 2019, there was a lot of community engagement that happened, municipalities involved, major planning entities involved. The project was sponsored by Cuyahoga County Planning Commission, and we were a major partner in it as well. And so this was a great way to kind of put all the ideas on the table and test it out with all of the communities in the county to really build this plan for what it looks like into the future, what our active transportation network looks like. This is a hard slide to see, but my intent in including it is just to say that it wasn't just drawing lines on maps. There was a lot of analysis that went into this as well in terms of what's the connectivity, how does the trail network interact with job centers and habitat and economic development and socioeconomic factors, so that there were different weights that were applied to the trails to figure out which rose in priority to be those critical gaps, those regional links, based on the connectivity that they would have and the populations they would connect.
Sarah, is this a map you can share with us later just so we can look at it in a little more detail? It's really interesting to see all that analysis that went into it.
Sure, yeah. And then also too, there's the Cuyahoga Greenways plan website. So if you go to cuyahogagreenways.com, there's a story map that you can interact with and look at that. And then all of this base information is on there as well.
That's perfect. Thank you.
Around. But the result, oh, sure. The result of this plan is that there were 12 critical gaps in purple you can see here. Most of these are pretty short pieces that provide the connection points to really build out the network where you're connecting a couple of, regional trails. And so these were high priority items. A lot of them are very short, but some of them are in very difficult areas. That's why they haven't been done yet. Then the 27 regional links and 30 key supporting routes. So in total, 69 projects and almost 250 miles of additional trails.
So a quick question, taking the critical gaps, presumably those are number one priority to address. Is part of this going to be a marshaling of all these data points to allow for marshaling of funding?
Absolutely. Yes.
And does NOAACA take the lead? Is there a specific formula, or does it vary in the locales?
So it's going to vary by the locales, because certain funding sources have, you know, a population group that they're going after, or you know, Clean Ohio might be more for a linking trail versus a loop trail. And so it does depend a little bit on the project, but we went into the Cuyahoga Greenways plan knowing that, you know, a lot of these projects span multiple municipalities and or are very difficult to build with some of those critical gaps. So we all need to work together to get it done and marshal the funds, as you said. So with NOAACA being the sponsor of this study, what they've done with their long range transportation plan that is almost complete now, they're finishing it up this year. All of these projects get integrated into that. So it becomes priority for NOAACA. And that's why it was really important to make sure that all the key agencies that are working on trails were a part of this effort, so that we had a good roadmap to go from. And having it in the long range transportation plan is a key to be able to access any of the federal transportation dollars.
So just sort of devil's advocate, if I have a community where I'm not as high on this list, but I see for my community that this is something important to do, in all likelihood, I have to fund that. I'm using first case, but that community really has to look to its own resources, because it's going to be lower in the pecking order. So the strength is, you can focus more dollars where the need has been identified. The downside is that individual communities may find that they're going to have to fare more on their own, even though they may be part of the system, they're farther down in the.
Yeah, that is the possibility. Of course, there are lots of different funding options as well. And some of those ones like Clean Ohio help kind of supplement that. I mean, we all compete for it.
This is to minimize competition and really to promote.
Right. And these are the ones that, I mean, it's really, if you build a highway and you've got a segment of a half a mile missing from it, you know, what's it's not going to get the same level of use that it should. And so that's the point of doing some of these critical gaps, is you've made major investments on either end. Let's link them together, because then suddenly, instead of, you know, 10 miles of contiguous trail, you have 30 miles of contiguous trail.
Understood, absolutely. Yeah.
Sarah. But that you do raise a very good point. And some of these are, you know, hoping that coming together and having multi-agency support will help make this more competitive in grant seeking.
How does that affect Metro Parks when it goes for funding for grants for connector trails?
Well, you know, a lot of the projects on here are projects that we're highly supportive of, and that kind of gets into some of the additional slides and the discussion.
Sorry.
With no, that's fine.
Let me ask one corollary to what Bruce is. To what extent would this limit our ability to take a fund for a project that someone may want and some limited community may want, and that may bring funding with them? So do we sort of have to say, wait, this comes first, even though you're funding this thing, we can't take possession of this trail because it's something that's not in the plan priorities.
No, I mean, this isn't.
So it doesn't limit our ability.
It doesn't limit our ability. There's still flexibility that's built into this, and this will need to be updated in a couple of years too, especially as one project gets built, then the emphasis on other projects might be lessened. Yeah, sure. It's a somewhat dynamic, sort of like our trails matrix, how things shift, the situation changes.
Right.
But in terms of of limiting, one of the things that we've looked at through Cuyahoga Greenway Partners, which is the collaborative that's trying to help implement this plan. And it's made up of Cleveland Metro Parks, County Planning, all the people that were basically a part of the stakeholder team for the Greenways plan, is that we're not very competitive as a region in terms of capturing these dollars. Like if you look at Franklin County, how much they get from Clean Ohio and some other programs, we're not collaborating as much and we're not, I think there's some bandwidth there to be able to capture.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And basically we have greater confidence now that the places that are targeted do deserve that targeting.
Right.
Yeah, nice.
Right.
Sarah, I was going to ask, how does this impact our trails matrix? Is it going to cause a number of shifts or has it already?
Well, I've got a couple of slides that cover that. So let's go. Great discussion. It does influence it. So we'll get to that in just a moment. But just to finish up here, the Greenway Partners, again, this is the group. It had formed out of the Greater Cleveland Trails and Greenways Conference that we didn't have any kind of group that was looking at the county holistically. That's how Cuyahoga Greenways Partners was put together, originally Trails Leadership Network. And then it was decided that we needed to have an overarching plan, thus the Cuyahoga Greenways plan. And now the group is continuing to meet and the executives of those organizations are meeting. We have a meeting at the end of the month with our executive team for the Cuyahoga Greenway Partners to advance the plans and to look at things like the funding opportunities, advocacy to expand funding, the collaboration. A lot of communities don't have, you know, even a planning staff to be able to advance some of these projects. And so how can we share with them information of how to get started, what the funding sources are? So there's educational components to what the how the Greenway Partners operates. And some of it's just, you know, here's a contact to talk to that's gone through this before.
That's excellent.
So there's a new website and it has a little bit more detail on the various projects. So, you know, definitely go to CuyahogaGreenways.com and look at it, play around on the site. You can look at individual projects, how they ranked, and there's a great amount of information. So on the right-hand side here, we have the current members of the Cuyahoga Greenway Partners. Recently added were ODOT, and then trying to do some outreach to mayors and city managers through Cuyahoga County Planning Commission, through their board and their kind of structure. But we have representation from most of the groups that do these larger projects.
Why the asterisk?
Because it's just kind of starting with them and then it's trying to disseminate through their board because each mayor represents kind of a subset of the county and to make sure that we're rolling down information about the plan and rolling up their plans for things that are happening in their community so that we have basically one landing page, one inventory of everything that's going on in the county. Because one of the other things that's important here is that coordinating on major capital projects. That's we've been holding infrastructure kind of sub meetings where sewer district is talking about their projects and then how that overlays with planned trails and how we can partner even more, even on a smaller level to get segments built. And it's that coordinated infrastructure that's huge because if you're already going to be digging up a hillside and digging up a roadway, that's the time to put in the trail or the facility that's already been planned.
Exactly.
So the funding question, we have our regular ongoing funding programs, you know, state capital. We're not very competitive on that with trails around here. That's something that we could, you know, potentially even put in one regional, one county level. This is our Cuyahoga Greenways blessed project and have it compete. We're not really getting anyhow.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Hey, Sarah, I just to add in too, that is why we are trying to do this. because of what she was saying, we have not been competitive. We have not come in with one real state big ask. The last real state funding for any type was the Wendy Park Bridge. And that was through a coalition of support that funding came through. So this is an opportunity to coalesce around some of these regional identities and the trails to really make this work. And if federal funding becomes available, we have projects ready to go.
Great. That's great.
Yeah. The new and discretionary funding opportunities are definitely an area that we're interested in through the Cuyahoga Greenway partners of, you know, that's the opportunity, like the Tiger program, to get a lot done in a shorter amount of time. And the partnerships and the collaboration are really key to doing that and to being able to say, this is an important project and the community agrees, these organizations agree. So we're working through all of that with the structure of the Cuyahoga Greenway partners and, you know, working from the plan, trying to implement it and go be aggressive about going after funding opportunities. And why we're doing this, obviously our connections is a huge goal for Cleveland Metro Parks. And the question that Commissioner Berry had about the trails matrix, sorry that my map is not very good, but this was the last round of trails matrix from 2019. And it factored in very much the Cuyahoga Greenways plan that helped sway the scoring or the methodology because there was community support for these trails through that planning process. And then just the names of those trails, which very busy map, sorry. But then another thing that we did, I don't know if you remember this, is we're not necessarily going to be leading all of these projects. Some of these we're going to be supportive of and help with letters of support or technical assistance. Some of these will be partners and some of these will lead. And I think that's the shift with the Cuyahoga Greenways plan is recognizing that we all might have kind of different responsibilities for each project, but we need to keep collaborating and communicating on these to advance them for the greater good.
Nice, very nice.
So again, asking you to adopt the plan. It is a very important foundational document for us in planning and design to lead our work. It integrates with our trails matrix. So it's along the lines of what we were doing already, but this just strengthens it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we felt that the adoption of the plan, even though it's been out for a little while, was a good step, especially as we're going into our strategic planning.
Sarah, may I make one comment here? Mm-hmm. One of the comments that came up during the audit committee meeting was the unprecedented enormity of the amount of money that's going to be shoveled in to Cleveland and Cuyahoga County in the next year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's in the order of, you know, the city's $500 million, which is more than, you know, if you look at their budget, the discretionary part of the Cleveland budget is bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
If we can tie in the construction of trails to a program that sort of a CCC WPA type program, which employs, which trains minority kids, you will fund that. That will definitely get paid for, and it won't be funds that would normally go to greenways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an extremely important concept because you're going to look back on this, these next 2 years, and some people are going to say, what the hell happened? You know, how on earth did this happen? And other people will look back on it as though the WPA, you know, when all in the park was, a lot of the really nice amenities of the park were built. So this happens really every other generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we happen to be the recipient of it now and absolutely have to attack that. I mean, even if it requires hiring consultants to help write up the proposals. You're going to get a lot for nothing because there's too much money to go around.
And we are trying to be very broad in our approach, looking at other funding sources, looking at how do we integrate what's coming, potentially coming through stimulus funds, all of that. And that's part of the reason to have that Cuyahoga Greenways group come together because it has all the major
leverage.
Yeah, and then it's not just those programs that are trail-based, because then they have their economic development folks, they have their infrastructure folks. And so it's brainstorming too for what are some other things, looking at, you know, EDA funding and some other ones that are kind of outside the box for what we would do typically. So it's, we're advancing that, but certainly the understanding that we need to really be able to move on some of these and be aggressive on it is first and foremost, and that's
be tiger-like.
And yeah. To be able to go to, say, the biggest school systems
mm-hmm.
and talk directly to the administrators, you know, to Eric mm-hmm. And the Cleveland system and to people that say, we will join you in this endeavor. So they have their stamp on it, because everyone's going to want to be hiring.
Mm-hmm.
All these government programs are going to be very focused towards minorities
mm-hmm.
and young people.
Yeah,
it's
very, very good.
Different taps that we normally look at.
Yep.
Excellent presentation.
Move to approve.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Thank you.
Very much appreciated. Sarah, excellent presentation. The next group we have is the award of bids. RFPs, recommended action falls in the top portion of page 16. I will not go through all of them, but it is more of a consent at that point in time.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Vouchers.
Vouchers and payroll.
Thank you, Brian. We have two resolutions for approval. The first is resolution 2103027. The following vouchers have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure conformity with the Ohio Revised Code for a total amount of $6,075,760.79. Recommended action is that we approve this resolution.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And the second resolution is 2103028. Also, having been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code, this total amount is $38.75 specific to Arborware.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Abstention.
Aye.
I abstain.
Dan Moore abstains.
Thank you.
Just testing.
Let's see, are we into public comments now?
Yes.
Yes.
Do we have any public comments?
Yes, we do have Marty Lesher has indicated that she would like to speak. I will work on unmuting her now.
I am here if you can hear me.
Okay, yeah. Marty, you're on. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just to counter some of the rosy reports, it is hard to deem it successful on a $45,000 increase in salaries paired with another $70,000 in other expenses, all described as offsets for Winter Fest revenue, produces a $27,000 loss at Merwin's Wharf without any capital expenses for igloos, ice rink, or heaters. Subsidies are actually worsening. There is no reason for Metro Parks to operate Merwin's Wharf in the winter at a loss. Using taxpayer money to make up the difference while local restaurants who pay taxes are struggling to even survive. Do them and us a favor and just leave it closed. Head and shoulder seasons may be reasonable, winter is not. Another questionable expense is the $25,000 donation to Lakewood for the highly subsidized Detroit Bridge redo. Collaboration is fine. APT improvements within the park will also benefit those using the bridge. But a direct contribution to a city is redirecting dollars that taxpayers elsewhere voted for their park. Beyond that, it certainly goes against all the recent talk about saving money. The very positive reputation that Metro Parks Rangers enjoyed for years is being damaged by aggressive enforcement from Metro Parks Police. I hear complaints of drivers getting tickets for minor issues, which used to result in warnings. It is doubtful that any increased court revenue can make up for the loss of goodwill. Community policing is highly praised for making a comeback elsewhere. Metro Park should not go the other way. Save tough enforcement for serious stuff. If you want the public's help in solving crimes, or if you just want them to support a levy, you had best not alienate them without cause. Adding alcohol everywhere surely contributes to bad behavior and need for policing. But beware of getting a reputation like some local police departments. Trust once lost is hard to regain. Thank you.
Bill, can I ask one question that relates to the Marvin Ward thing? If you looked at just the whole year without winter, what is the rough math? And then if you just looked at the winter slice all by itself, what's the loss on that?
So in a non-COVID year, typically speaking for Merwin's Wharf, we're going to end up at around a 3 or 4% operating profit, sometimes as high as 5%. We are, I will say, intentional about not wanting to drive too much profit through an organization like that, because again, it is also taxpayers that are paying for the use of that. So we're aware of that and want to make sure that we're as competitive as we can be from a pricing perspective. Wintertime months, we run at a loss, typically.
But how big a loss? And if you look at the whole winter?
If I just look at the winter months, I'll have to get back to you with a figure on that. We tend to look at it in the course of a year. And yeah. To Marty's comment, isolating a slice of time during the year does not typically represent the actual impact. The other thing it doesn't represent is having a facility like that. You can be myopic in your view and say simply it's a bottom line figure, but I think you also have to look at the community contribution, the value of the real estate, what's happened down in that area after we took the initial leap in getting that property. It actually uplifted values there, and further development ensued. So the contributions are significant to both us as an organization and to the community with a facility like Merwin's.
Yeah, the reason we did it was not to make money on a restaurant. The reason we did it was to populate that area and to create some sort of an action there, which I think it's done. And I think irrespective of losing money during the winter, I think you have to keep that entity there during the winter, because people do, you know, there are also there's activities going on there during the winter. So I think it, in spite of losing the money during the winter, I think there's a reason to do it.
This is all consistent with the TPL.
Well, and one thing also to take into consideration is while on a spreadsheet there's that loss, you can't just shutter the restaurant, lay off all the staff, and try to rehire them again next year. Yep. The amount of taxpayer dollars that would go into that process would greatly outweigh these minimal losses. Also, these staff help out elsewhere, all across the Metro Park system during those downtimes. But they're also facilitating the Lock 44 room and community meetings and things of that nature, which obviously aren't supposed to be profit driven. So I think Merwin's Wharf has been a tremendous success. I've had restaurateurs tell us it's a tremendous success. They're so happy that it's there and available for the community. The fact that we can pull in over $2 million in top line revenue in a restaurant that is only typically busy during those peak months in the summer, I think is a tremendous accolade and success for the Metro Parks.
We only need to go back a little more than 10 years where people just would not, as you said, populate that area. It's a totally transformed environment. And
I mean, it was
we should feel very positive about that. It's not just the one item, it's a collection.
It was a place where you'd find needles on the ground. I mean, it just was not, I think it's been a tremendous success. Very good. And the comment on giving money to Lakewood, that was for one of our purposes. So it was.
I also would like to comment too on you know the proactive policing, and you know it's been one of the things that I'm not exactly sure Ms. Lesher's comments meet the ends. Meaning, you know our parkways at certain times of the year become thoroughfares, and we do have a tremendous amount of bikers that do use the park as well, that are taxpayers as well. And you know when COVID hit, you know some of the numbers started to spike. We were seeing speeds excess of 15, 16, 20 miles per hour in the parkway. And so I'm not sure if Ms. Lesher is saying that those people should not get tickets, but that is not necessarily the case. We need to be proactive in protecting our bike and bikeways throughout the entire Metro Parks purview. and our officers do work with discretion, and they do work at being proactive, and they are out there being active. So I'm not exactly sure what our comment is saying that we should allow for speeders and hazard conditions. So having said that, we will move into our information.
Really quick, Brian, I just want to say thank you for saying that. Not only bikers, but pedestrians. Speeds have gone up across the country with less people on the roads, and it is extremely dangerous. And as a walker all the time, I mean, not only in the metro parks, but across the cities, cars are going so fast. I think we need to have some increased enforcement and try to slow people back down again, because it's saving lives. There's a website in the city of Cleveland that tracks every day a person being hit by a vehicle somewhere. It's gotten significantly worse. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, this goes back to Sarah. It's the you're talking about low stress and high stress, and we should be low stress, not high.
I'm sorry.
And the parks weren't designed to be a interstate highway. They were designed for what they are. And our police force is being proactive. And that is a very positive story.
Yes, thank you.
The next part of the agenda is the information and briefing items, Hilliard Road Bridge Replacement Update. Sean?
Good morning again. Thank you, Brian. Good morning, commissioners. I have with me here today Nicole English, the Planning and Programming Administrator from Cuyahoga County Department of Public Works. In January, we were before you and we introduced the Hilliard Road replacement project and received a lot of good feedback. I think we had some very good, open, robust discussion. We felt it was best to bring back the project's sponsor. We do work very well with Cuyahoga County and Department of Public Works on many projects, many bridges. And we're happy to bring them before you here this morning. So.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me. So I don't know how much you went into last time and how much you want to hear. So I'll go quickly through the slides, but if there's anything you want me to go back to or talk about in detail, I'm happy to do that. So Cuyahoga County is the project sponsor because we are the owners of Hilliard Road Bridge. We built it originally in 1925. And I-90 bridge came next to it in the 60s, which kind of blocked half of the bridge from sight unless you're traveling on the interstate. I'm sure you're all pretty familiar with where it is. It crosses between Lakewood and Rocky River. So as part of our project team, we've been working closely with both cities and the metro parks. In addition to ODOT, because they are a project sponsor, and NOAACA, they also have money in the project. So a little bit of background is in 2013, we did a bridge inspection, which then led us to realize we needed to program a project in the near future. So in 15, we looked at a feasibility study that was prepared and it by our consultants, Trans Systems, and they did recommend rehabilitation at the time for the bridge. In 2018, we went back out to do a new bridge inspection in preparation for the actual design contract. And at that time, we had significant accelerated deterioration of the structure. Also, go through some photos. This kind of changed our position as to where we were going to go as far as could rehab really work anymore, or would a replacement be an option that we have to look at now? This is just a quick some photos where you can compare 2013 to 2018. The underside of the arches, lots of concrete falling off, exposing the steel. This is consistent across the whole bridge. Again, more deterioration. You could see a beam in 2013, 2018, now totally exposed. I mean, this is, you know, mainly just due to the weather, the salt, freeze thaw of, you know, the condition, the climate that we're in. Here we go again, just some more arches and bridge piers. So this is just trying to tell the story of what happened, because a lot of people have come to us saying, in 13, you said that you could rehab the bridge. What happened in 5 years? And the fact that we saw this much happening in 5 years made us really take a look, because what was going to happen in the next 5-20 out. You might be aware, if you drive under it, we do have safety netting on because concrete pieces were falling onto your trail. And obviously that's not something that we want to happen. So we've had to put up increased netting to catch the pieces that are falling down from underneath. So we looked at a purpose and need for the project. So it's obviously to address the poor condition, but to improve safety for vehicles and pedestrians on the bridge. We do have restricted traffic loads right now over top of the bridge for some heavy emergency vehicles. So we'd like to be able to take those off for the future. and then improve safety for the park visitors under the bridge, because that's been a problem in the past. Like I said, we've been working with several stakeholders. Trans Systems is our consultant team with those subs listed there. We've been having several stakeholder meetings and steering committee meetings. So the key issues we're trying to address with the project are figuring out the useful life. Rehab is probably closer to a 25-year life. We'd like to see a new bridge give us 75 years of life. So addressing the purpose and need, looking at the historic bridge impacts, we understand the context of the bridge, what it looks like. It is historic. People like it. It's a, you know, an icon for this area. So we're not blind to that. Environmental impacts related to the park, 6F in the river. Actually, there's a pier currently in the river. That's something we're looking to move to help the flow of the traffic or the water. Maintenance of traffic, whether it has to be shut down, not how the cars will move around it, and the traveling public underneath. And right-of-way impacts, how much land we would need to build it, and then project costs. So these are all the things we're looking at. So the first look is, was rehab or replacement? So we had to look at four different alternatives. One is do nothing, no build. Obviously, that meets none of the purpose and need. It would sit there, deteriorate, and get worse. Then the rehab option. So the rehab option, essentially to rehab anything, we'd have to take it all the way down to the concrete arches. So 70% of the bridge would not remain intact. And then when I get to it, I'll show you, there would be additional wrapping that would be required in order to even keep it going. Alternative three was removal of the existing bridge and replace on the existing alignment. Alternative four, ODOT made us look at this, replacing the structure on a new alignment. So we'll take it just to the south and you leave the old bridge up. So you still had the historic bridge up, but it would continue to deteriorate. You would have those costs. You'd have two bridges. It's kind of a silly alternative in our mind, but it's something that ODOT makes you look at. So we had selected alternative three, rehab. This just goes through in more detail the alternatives. No build, I think everybody's familiar with what that does. Here we talk about the rehab, where everything above those concrete arches would have to be touched and in some ways removed. The photo over to the right is how the fabric wrapping would go on to some of the concrete elements. So it wouldn't even really look like it does today, because you'd have this, what I would view as kind of ugly base wrapping. Cabbage. Yeah. So again, that's the hard thing. People really want to save the bridge, but saving the bridge isn't going to look like it does today. It still would look different. It would have elements. It would also only give us 25 years of design life and could cost $52 to $53 million. And that's even a ballpark number. As soon as they start working on the bridge, I mean, we've seen this in other places, you start digging and it's falling off. So the cost could go up and up. So here's the removal of the existing bridge and replacing. There's several options I'll get to further on, but this is just some idea of what it could look like as far as where the piers could go. Giving a 75 year design life, 2 to 3 year of detour during construction. So that is impactful to note.
Now the price you had on that, 40 to 55 million, that seems awfully low.
So we'll get to a slide further on that actually looks at different types of bridges and then costs by that. So when I get to that, we maybe could discuss it in more detail. This was the realigned alignment, just so you understand what that was saying. Build a bridge to the south, leave the old bridge. I don't think this makes much sense. Neither did the public. Here was the comparison chart just to show that we did look at all those project needs. It's detailed. You could look at it in more detail, but the main thing is to look at, obviously the bridge replacement has the most green and yellow. That's the beneficial. It does have a red in the fact that the historic bridge gets removed. And the no build has an equal amount of green, but that's because there's no impact because you do nothing and there's no construction, but you really don't get anywhere with that. So this is the matrix that we use to drive our decision to replace the bridge. I think I talked through all of this, why we picked alternative two. Or alternative three, sorry, why alternative two wasn't selected. So then we get into the structure type study. So now that we decided we're replacing the bridge based on all the input we've gotten, how are we replacing it? What is it going to be replaced with? And so these are all the things that we had to consider as part of the structure type study. And then here's where we got. So here's the six alternatives that our consultants have looked at. It's a wide range, starting from straight steel plate girder profile, kind of like a typical highway bridge, like the one that you would see to the north on I-90.
Sterile.
Yes, a typical ODOT bridge. So when we get to funding, ODOT does have significant money in the project because it's a local major bridge, and so they have a program that contributes to that. We have almost $20 million from ODOT. So they have a big say. So they had, you know, they make you look at the most basic bridge and then work your way up. So we have done that. Alternative two is a haunch steel plate girder. So it gives us a little bit more geometry, you know, try to make it a touch more interesting than alternative one. Alternative three is a delta steel plate girder, kind of like the Interbelt bridges, that look that would give you a little bit more flare, but still would put the piers where they're placed. I don't know if it gets you the look that you want, and the cost goes up, and for the lifetime maintenance because there's more to paint on the steel and that kind of thing. So alternative four is pre-stressed concrete beam, kind of like an interstate bridge, just concrete, right? So instead of steel, it would be concrete straight, a little bit boring, needed more piers, one that would be in the river. Then we get to the pre-stressed concrete arch, which gets you similar to what you have today. Not exactly, it would probably not look identical. It'd be kind of how we did Fulton, right? We replaced it, it looks similar, not exactly the same, a little more modern, but still has the concrete arches. Obviously this one comes with the most cost. And then a steel arch, you'd go do a similar to alternative five, except it would be steel. So there'd be additional lifetime costs for that because you have to paint steel more often and it costs a lot to touch all those elements with paint. So those are the six things we're looking at right now. Currently, we had collected public comment up until earlier this month. We're still open to comment if people want to on our website. This, we're still working through, the structure type study has gone to ODOT with all this information in it. They have approved it, but we are still working on the environmental side and taking public input to be sure that we're selecting the alternative that works best for everyone. So here's the cost that I said we would get to. These are in 2023 costs, which is what our fiscal year is that we need to construct the project. And like you said, some might seem low. They have been vetted by the consultant. This is pure construction cost, so it doesn't include construction engineering, which I would put another 10% on. They do have some contingency factors in there. So we think they're a little bit on the light end, but again, this has been vetted by the consultant, so we're using these as our comparison for right now. Obviously, the concrete arch is the most expensive. It's complicated and, you know, not built every day. As you can imagine, the straight steel plate girder is the cheapest, along with the concrete beams. You know, there's nothing fancy. It's pretty straightforward.
Between five and six, long-term upkeep, any comparison?
You're like, you saw my presentation ahead of time. Here's the next one. Here's our lifetime cost. So the cost of the steel arch is higher on the lifetime cycle, and this is because of the painting. So you have to paint it twice within the life cycle. So we looked at a 75-year life cycle. Steel gets painted two cycles. The concrete beams get sealed, but the sealing is a lot easier and cheaper to do. The painting is pretty expensive, especially when you have multiple pieces that you have to touch. These also assume a bridge deck overlay at year 25, a bridge deck replacement at year 50, and then you assume in year 75, all of them would have to be replaced. So, and this is all lifetime costs of the superstructure, which is above the ground, because the substructure is intended, it'd probably be the same for all of them. So on a comparison basis, we're just looking at what you see above the ground that would be differential for the different.
Five looks like Best Buy.
Well, so we're, here's the issue. Funding, right? So the county is currently received from ODOT, like I said, local major bridge, almost $20 million from them, which doesn't cover nearly enough of the project. NOAACA has committed an STP fund 7.5. Those two pieces make us have a local match of about 6.8 at the county level. So right now in hand, we have about $34 million, right? So that's for the construction and construction engineering of the project. So when we go back and look at the alternatives, that's a big gap.
So is there federal funding for infrastructure?
So So we are continuing to look at other funding options, especially now there's new funding coming around. We're taking the public input. What we were kind of pushing towards with ODOT's help is they have a hard time with that $50 million number. When you look at a matrix and you compare the benefits, again, you only see the bridge from one side. You only see it some of the seasons, because once the trees are in action, you can't really see it that well. Is there money better spent other places? Can we do more improvements to the park, to the connections up top? Can we provide, you know, the bike lanes and pedestrian walkways? And can we put outlooks on the top of the bridge? Is the money better spent, a smaller amount of money, better spent in places where people will actually get some use out of it? So that's driving the environmental process right now, looking at all the comments that we're receiving. I did take a quick look at the public comments. They closed about a week or two ago. There is a lot of people saying, you know, this bridge, the look of it, you know, we're really sad to see it go, but we also understand, I've seen the concrete falling. I understand it looks bad. I know it needs to be replaced. So it seems replacement, everybody understands that needs to happen. And we have been getting comments saying, you know, this is an important link across down into the metro parks. What can you do to help us with that piece? So can this bridge project also bring you other benefits? And that's what we're working really closely with the metro park staff on.
That last point, I'm sorry to interrupt. But
that's okay.
You've said more than once, you only see it from one side. That's not particularly accurate though, is it?
Well, I mean, if you're driving a 90, you see it, but it is
different.
But up close, pretty close to 90. And so
if you're down in the park though, you do see that superstructure from all angles. I mean, I think that's the thing that probably has struck us more, not just intuitively, but anecdotally, that you mm-hmm. really do have the sculptural effect of the existing bridge down in the park. So it's a bit of a stretch, but it's a park amenity in that regard. So mm-hmm. I don't think that more subjective component should be treated simply as it's 50% good on one side and you don't consider it on the other. I think that's a little limited.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you do see it from down below, and I think we've pushed in our environmental.
Use the park down below.
Right. The question is just where is the money come from? So at some point, if we don't have $50 million to build the bridge, we can't build a project, right? So we are working to try to identify other funding sources. ODOT is also oversight on the bridge. And so they, you know, they also have pushed us back to say, even when we were saying, you know, we don't want the straight steel plate girder bridge, they said, well, you got to prove to us why you don't, because for right now, it's the cheapest option. It's the least impact to the park. It could be done quicker. You know, they had reasons why. So we had to push back on this kind of information that, is that the best, you know, view from the park? Can we do a little bit better? Can we give them something else? What can we add on the top? So we've even pushed back to ODOT to try to get off of alternative one.
We support your pushback.
Yeah.
So Nicole, how do those long-term costs factor in? Some of the, like option five had the lowest long-term cost, and you're saying if you don't have the money now, that's a problem. But what if we don't have the money in the future when these improvements have to be made to the bridge because it's obviously going to deteriorate?
So the difference, the lifetime costs that I'm showing now are brought back to, these are overall costs that are brought back to, I believe these are $20, $20, just to compare them. So there is a difference over time. I think this is still way less. I mean, $5 million between 2 and 5 over 75 years versus $20 million today. I mean, it's still a big, yeah, that there is a difference, but I think that the delta in the initial cost is still so much higher that, again, if we don't have the funds and cannot get the funds, we can't dedicate. The county takes in around $20 million a year in license plate taxes. That's how we fund most of our projects. So, I mean, that would be the $20 million difference would be an entire year of our program that we would have to give just to this.
Just bridge. Remember, though, the Metro Parks gave this air rights right of way with the understanding that there was a commitment to aesthetics that was built into the existing bridge. For ODOT to treat this now as no memory, no historical memory, defeats the purpose of the easement that was provided.
Well, Bruce, is ODOT even aware of that? I mean, we know that. They may not.
Well, that's recorded. No, that's recorded. Yeah. That's real. That's historic.
Yeah, we have been in communication, gotten your documents, and we've had our right-of-way folks doing research to find what they have on the books. So we are aware. We do have the documents that we found.
Yeah, well, that's significant. I mean, the reason that the Metro Parks did it is because this is an area where people go to get away from the city, and to rebuild something that is going to be truly sterile defeats the whole purpose of the grant in the first place. That was the trade-off.
Yep.
So the time value of money is built into that bridge.
Right.
There's one other comment about regarding how long the bridge is going to last. So the bridge that's there now has been up how long?
It was built in 1925.
Yeah, so it's
so it'll be about 100 years by time.
Not 75 years. And there's been a lot of improvements with the way concrete is behaving and the way steel is being, the rebar is being treated. So to think that the potential is much more than 75 years. Certainly we're better than we were before. And I think the other point is, with the steel arch approach, if you could accelerate this fast enough to get the steel, the super, not the main beams, but the superstructure, the arches and all, on number six, if you could order it now for delivery a little bit later, if you can commit to it more quickly, I would think the steel would last longer. I mean, it's not that expensive to paint a bridge. You know, the ability of the road surface to shed the salt water is much better now than it used to be. It never used to be even considered. So I would think the steel arch approach is number one, gonna last much longer. Maybe it may have to be painted three times, not two. Paint is much, much better than it was, you know, 100 years ago. So I think you've done a wonderful job analyzing the alternatives, and we certainly appreciate that you're doing that.
Yes.
But we do feel really strongly about keeping the aesthetics of the bridge.
Yes.
And we had the same case with Whiskey Island, the Whiskey Island Bridge. And here the aesthetics are closer. The cost of the aesthetics is not as high as it was down there on a percentage basis. Down there, it was extremely expensive difference. This isn't so bad. The percentage. I mean, witnessing the fact that concrete will last longer, but steel will also last longer. So you've got to lead the duck on this a little bit.
Nicole, is there not an option for a structurally significant superstructure, but an artistic arch that isn't load bearing that can fit into the design to keep those aesthetics, but it'll be a cost effective, you know, method of building the bridge?
Sorry, I was trying to go back to the
gingerbread.
Did I read your mind?
So, you know, we have talked to the consultants after the public input has come back and said, is there some hybrid that we could look at that isn't so number two, but isn't totally number five? So that is something we're going back to the consultants with. And again, we need the environmental to feed that, because if nobody says anything about it, then ODOT says, okay, build the cheapest bridge. I mean, that's what they want, right? The cheapest, quickest, less impactful to the environment. So that's why this public comment is good and helpful.
A repeat, you know, but we do represent a large public entity. So I repeat what Dan said. We really do appreciate the level of detail you've provided. So we're not shooting a messenger per se.
Yes,
but
we understand.
But the message has to be loud and clear. The aesthetics of this really do matter. And
right.
I go back to the foundation of this bridge, so to speak, was Metro Parks saying, you can have this easement gratis. Well, not exactly. You got to build a bridge that works aesthetically. And I think that message has to be, and we'll deliver it as best we can. We'll be as supportive as we can be, but we certainly urge you to consider that we're a public voice reflecting a large constituency. You know, you can canvas so much, you can get so much public input through the media that you've been using, but I think we have a responsibility to amplify that.
Yeah, and I know we've gotten a letter from the Metro Parks regarding this too. I mean, that's what we need, right? We need the data to be able to take it back, because again, if we just all talk about it and we don't have anything.
Well, that's, we appreciate your being here for that reason, because it's critical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How did we get there with the Fulton Road Bridge? Because obviously that replacement was aesthetically, you know, similar to the original bridge. Was there the same level of financial gap? And where did that money come from? Do you know?
I don't know. That predates me at the county. But I know we did look at costs for that. So that's where we have looked to compare the costs on Alternative 5. I don't know their full funding package on Fulton. I mean, that was years ago. Mm-hmm. I think the complication on the construction was even more difficult over on Fulton just because of the zoo. But we could get some more information on Fulton, and I don't know what their alternatives they looked at and how much difference. I think I understand Hilliard is higher, and so there is a few other complications that make it more expensive. I think
gotcha.
So.
Like,
if there's more we can provide, we definitely will do that.
Can I ask one more question? It's a deep span, comparatively deep. Was a suspension bridge ever considered, just the old-fashioned type of suspension bridge?
No. No, they didn't look at a suspension bridge at all.
Steel town. But I wonder what that would be, because it's not a particularly high load bridge, or would this be? Would this be, could you carry a heavy piece of equipment across the
Well, they want no restrictions.
Not right now, you can't, but in the future, the hope is you can get the load restrictions.
So what would that, what weight would that be? Let's say, what would the weight limit on the new bridge, new alternative 6 be, would you guess?
I'd have to ask the designers on that.
It would be, you know, probably 100,000 pounds, wouldn't it? Something like that, or 80.
I wouldn't want to speculate, but they would know the details for sure. I mean, the idea is to get all the load limits off, though, so that the normal traveling public, even heavy loads could go across, that would go across the normal, you know, interstate bridge. And I guess related to your question about, you know, ordering the steel ahead of time. So we, you know, this is a federally funded project, so we have to go through the environmental process. I have a couple slides on schedule.
Nicole, just before we move on, I just clarify the record, and we memorialized in our communication to you and for the commissioners, you know, there's not an actual easement in place yet. When that original right was granted, it wasn't memorialized in writing as it needs to be. And so that's why we, with even more urgency, show up to say that the consideration that the park board in the past gave for this aesthetically pleasing bridge, that's why it's so important. And so we continue to communicate so that we can shore up the documentation, mm-hmm. and just so that we can get that on the record and clarify.
No, thanks for clarification. Appreciate it.
But I do think you should also look at a suspension bridge. I mean, just that is an attractive bridge.
They're so far along.
It would be, it's pretty deep for the kind of bridge you've got here. Suspension bridges are changing as we've seen the economics of those rather dramatically change, particularly when someone can offer a more or less fixed design. It's simpler to build, I would think. Particularly if you're not running over a railroad. that might be something to just look at.
We can ask them why they didn't, but I don't know if that solves your problem with underneath the bridge and keeping some of the historic elements that you want.
It makes it attractive. I think that's what we're concerned about.
So there is going to be a whole nother stage. Once we select the bridge type, a whole set of aesthetic treatments that we're going to look at. And so there'll be aesthetic treatments from underneath, what the piers look like, what we could add to them, color on top, if there's overlooks, if there's connections. So there's a whole another piece of steering committee and stakeholder meetings that we're going to go through to talk about aesthetic treatment, the fencing, the lighting, you know, every piece of the bridge, under, over. So that's once we have to pick the type, so you know what you're putting on it. And then there'll be a whole set of meetings surrounding that we're going to, in public input, a second public meeting, which you see in May, in order to go through the aesthetics that then you add onto the bridge. But until you know what you're building, you can't really say, I want, you know, the piers to look like X if you don't know how many piers or what they are. So there will be a whole round of meetings that we're going to talk about aesthetics and adding elements that even from below that you can see that would add to the look of the bridge. So even if it's not the concrete arch that you go forward with, that there is something we can do as far as stamping in the piers, memorializing, putting, I mean, we can even, you know, put plaques and stories into them. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things we can do that are probably a lot cheaper than the $20 million if that's what we're still trying to figure out. I mean, that's part of the problem is that, sorry, I keep picking the wrong slide. Again, we have 34 million. I don't have 50 million plus another 10% to build a bridge right now. Could we find additional sources? Yes, we're actively looking. We've talked to ODOT about the upcoming request for earmarks and looking at this, the gap in this bridge, and also even including some of the projects related to Hogs Back Lane into that earmark request. If it comes through, could we change in our direction? I mean, that's a possibility. But for now, we still have a $20 million gap if we want to go with that concrete arch, and we can't build it that way. So at some point, you either want to build a bridge or we get stuck and we can't build it. And the problem we have is this money is in fiscal year 2023. ODOT has told us the $19.8 million that it is in 23, and if you guys don't spend it there, there is an option to pull it back. Will they pull it back? I mean, they typically don't, but they can threaten.
We get all that and appreciate
and
it.
Yeah. So we, you know, try to work in good faith towards those dates that we've given them.
Understood. Well, it's very informative. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for looking at all those options. I do think we'll be very interested in, you know, what Joe suggested, if there's some sort of a hybrid that comes out and what that cost is and how it might aesthetically look. But we'd like to see that for sure.
All right. And if there's any more questions, our website, we still have all the public information up there. All these studies are linked. So if anybody or your constituents, anybody wants to look at anything, it will stay up on our website. So there's all the background information, the structure type study, it explains all of these things. So if anybody, you know, is calling you or wants more information, just direct them to the Public Works Cuyahoga County website.
Very well, thank you again.
Thank you.
And Nicole, I did watch the first public meeting that you guys did online, and it was a really good meeting, same similar presentation to just what you went through here, but it was very clear, I think. So you guys are doing a nice job.
Yeah, and that's still on too. So it's a slideshow that it has talking to it. So if someone wants to watch it, they can, there is some explanation. It's more than just trying to watch a slideshow on your own. So that's helpful too. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nicole. And we appreciate the county and ODOT's diligence on this process. And again, I think all the points were very well made about the aesthetics of this bridge and the intent. And so we look forward to hopefully coming to a very positive outcome for our 19 plus million visitors that go through the park. We are now on to the last information item. It is the 2020 real estate report. And I believe Stephanie and the team are ready to go.
Yes, good morning, commissioners, and thank you, Brian. Here to present our 2020 real estate acquisition numbers. We kind of titled this report 2020, a year of resiliency. I think we all know it was a challenging year, but I think the beauty is that land preservation was still a top priority for us, and we had a lot of great accomplishments over the year that we'd like to highlight. So I'll just get into a few things that we're going to highlight today are, we call it conservation at a glance. So those are kind of those year-end numbers. Where is our acreage today? How many acres did we acquire, and where that acreage was located? I'll go through each acquisition that we did acquire in 2020 and just kind of explain how we got there, you know, whether it was funding or partners. Conservation by the numbers, so we'll highlight in what communities we acquired, the properties. And then, you know, the really big highlight of 2020 is that we surpassed that 24,000 acre mark. So we ended the year with a great number and, you know, all through sort of a challenging year. And then I want to talk a little bit too about our stewardship. While, you know, land acquisition is so important for our real estate team, we also need to take care of the acreage that we have. And so we do that through monitoring encroachments and conservation easements and upholding our deed restrictions. So we'll touch on that a bit as well. So this map here on the left highlights all the properties that we acquired in 2020. I'm not going to go through them right now because each slide to come will go through each acquisition, but you can see that the acquisitions really span the county. So we, you know, going from west to east, we have properties that we acquired in Bradley Woods and then moving south into Mill Stream Run, Rexville, Hinckley, over to the east in Bedford and South Chagrin, and then in our urban parks as well. So Washington, West Creek, Garfield Park and Lakefront. So we really spanned a good, you know, span of the entire park district. And so we're pretty happy about that, just making sure we kind of touch in all the different reservations and communities. So in summary, we acquired property through 17 transactions and a total of 277 acres. And this brought our total acreage up to 24,093 acres. So as I said, we surpassed that mark. 61 of those acres were donated either through conservation partners or through private donations. And we valued that 61 acres at over $1.7 million. Our land acquisitions costs totaled over $4 million, and a lot of that was funded through grants. So grant funds covered 54% of that $4 million that we purchased. So if you take the donated property along with the land that we acquired and purchased, we acquired nearly just over $5.8 million in real estate. And just to kind of break it down, Cleveland Metro Parks funds went 32% of our funds went towards that 5.8 million, and then 39% was funded by grants and 29% by donations. So
that's a great ratio.
Can you repeat that, please?
So Cleveland Metro Parks funds was 32% of the total land that we acquired. 39% was grants and 29% was donations, either private or other conservation organizations. So we're kind of on that third, but grants was a little bit higher at nearly
40%. Yeah, very nice.
So we were able to acquire parkland in 12 communities and 10 reservations. And just to kind of highlight, what did we preserve? What are we, you know, looking to protect? Over 17,000 feet of headwater streams, nearly 8,000 feet of rivers and creeks. We acquired 1.1 miles of property for existing and future trail connections. And we protected 11 acres of wetland and 198 acres of forest. So I'll just go through each of the properties just to kind of give you, I know we've seen these as you guys provided approval over the past year, but just kind of nice to look back and see some of the big accomplishments. And we're gonna start with the grant funded properties. This is the CEI property. It's over 88 acres in Bedford Reservation. So this is Alexander Road down here, so just north of Alexander Road and south of Astorhurst Park. It's located in Walton Hills. It protects a lot of wooded ravines, and it was purchased with Clean Ohio funds, or partially with Clean Ohio funds.
Where is that on this slide?
So I'm sorry. So this is a picture of the property, and then you'll see these arrows. This black box is actually the property itself.
Thank you.
So the property here to the north, we acquired with Clean Ohio funds. That was about 16 acres. Then we acquired Astor's Park another following year with Clean Ohio funds. That's 127 acres. And then this additional 88 acres. So this entire block here, you know, just a handful of years ago didn't even exist. And through working with Clean Ohio and our partners, we've been able to acquire, you know, a lot of acres.
That's excellent.
This is a quick video. So for those that are home, you may not hear any sound. I'll try and narrate a little bit. But this is the CEI property, which is a quick aerial view. We often prepare these videos for our grant sources to kind of get a feel for the property. So this is standing or above at Astorhurst, and you're looking over this wooded property. So you can imagine if all this woods was developed, how that would completely change Astorhurst Park. Again, it's 88 acres, and I know we're tired of looking at snow at this point, but with the trees off, you can really see the streams below and all the forested acreage. There's nearly 5 acres of wetlands, 3 primary headwater streams. And again, you're looking from Astorhurst Park into the CEI property. There is an adjacent industrial development just to right next to this property. So again, that industrial parkway could have been extended and this 88 acres would have been developed. So completely kind of changing up what that Astorhurst Park would look like if it was slammed against development. So. Our next property is also grant funded. This is in Hinckley Reservation. So you can say this is the Rising Valley Park area of Hinckley Reservation. The east branch of the Rocky River flows down through Hinckley and then north up towards Mill Stream Run Reservation. So an important corridor that we've been really working to protect. This is nearly 25 acres that we acquired from the Rob property. It protects the east branch of the Rocky River. It has a lot of nice habitats, some wetlands, meadows, forests, so just a really great property. And then, you know, with each acquisition, it really gives us the opportunity to continue to expand. So just to the north of this now, in 2021, we should be closing on an additional 53 acres. So every time we pick up a piece, it really helps us build along those corridors.
Yeah.
Next, we're in the Millstream Run Reservation, just north of Royalton Road and west of Webster Road. This is the Spearneck property, and this was a challenge. It was acquired through grant funds, through the Conservation Fund, who administered the Ohio Forested Habitat Fund, as well as a private landowner, the Catanzarite family. So we were able to work through this transaction, which was challenging because we had to go through an entire lot split process, a rezoning process, working with the grant source, and then working with a private donor as well. So with the assistance of all of them, we were able to acquire 24 acres. A big thank you to the Catanzarite family. They owned a small strip at the northern end of this and the western end of this property, which when they donated that property, it allowed the full 24 acres to be connected to Millstream Run Reservation. So to continue on with donated properties, this is the Kasdan property in Moreland Hills. This is South Chagrin Reservation near Jackson Field, if you're familiar with that part of South Chagrin. This is actually the second donation that the Kasdan family has made to Cleveland Metro Parks. They had originally donated a side lot on their property, and we worked with them to split the 7.2 acres behind their home on Skyline Drive. So this is a very sensitive conservation area. I know our natural resources staff is so excited to have better access to this area. There's a lot of really sensitive species up on the hillside. So really just protecting the Chagrin River Valley. And then continuing with donations in the West Creek Reservation, we have entered into a fourth lease amendment with West Creek Conservancy. So all the circles that you can see here to the right are properties that came with this lease amendment, which totaled nearly 52 acres. So this portion up here, this is Ridgewood, West Ridgewood Drive. So this continues the reservation up to Grantwood. Then we have some acquisitions here to help with, you know, the future connection of what will be hopefully the West Creek Greenway, getting down to Pleasant Valley Road, more access here, and then also continuing the reservation east across Broadview Road into Seven Hills and Independence. One really unique thing about this donation is this is our first land holding in Seven Hills. So that brings our total communities that we serve up to 49 distinct communities.
Stephanie, does that connection exist, that purple over there to the right?
Yes, that is a trail maintained by Seven Hills.
Okay.
And so the goal is to extend, you know, I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry, I'm going the wrong way here. So the goal is to extend on what they call the West Creek Greenway. So we could get, you know, from Grantwood down through the reservation over to Broadview Road. This trail does exist, and then continue the trail further east.
Into that property. Great.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And something I just want to mention with donations, we talk a lot about property donations, either through our conservation partners, private landowners, but it is important to note that our land donations first need approval by the probate court before we can have acceptance by our board. So each time we look at a donation, we prepare documents for the probate judge to approve. So you can see we've had 9 different probate judges over the years, and I just kind of listed the amount of transactions or donations that each of them have approved. So, you know, Anthony Judge Russo, our current probate judge, has been very active. You can see, you know, in the recent history, there haven't been that many donations. So he's had 6 transactions per year, and over the course of our history, nearly 400 donations of land. So I just kind of wanted to highlight, you know, that important piece of our donations, and, you know, a big thank you to our probate judges for helping us with those. Brecksville Reservation was a big year for 2020. We had 4 separate transactions in Brecksville Reservation. The first here where that star is just east of Broadview Road, in the city of Broadview Heights, and it was actually up for sale as a government auction. And it is, you know, directly adjacent to Valley Parkway, so it was just kind of an important acquisition to help buffer Seneca Reservation. So we were the highest bidder on that auction and were able to acquire an additional 1.7 acres. And then moving a little bit to the east here is the Gertzma property. This property was 12.7 acres. In the previous year, we had acquired the Przysinski property, which was right next to it, and just kind of led on to another property that would be adjacent. So this is another really great property. It's in a really highly sensitive sub watershed for Brexville Reservation, and just something we were pretty excited to pick up. And then over here, we have the Packard property. This is interesting. So it's hard to see, but this is Rising Valley Park, the northern part of Hinckley Reservation here. We received this donation from Braemar Farms a number of years ago, and then that allowed us to, you know, continue that connection and acquire the Packard property. And then here in 2021, there's another property right here, the 75 acres that we hope to close on. So again, continuing that connection from Hinckley up into Brexville and Millstream Run reservations. And then lastly is this Western Reserve Land Conservancy property. We've worked with Western Reserve to acquire this from Goodrich, and it's another 48 acres. So you can see this, again, kind of big block of property that has been established over the last few years. We worked with Western Reserve Land Conservancy to acquire this 102 acres, and then this year, and an additional 48 acres. And then 2020 also marked the end of our land acquisitions for the Tiger Trails. So we needed to secure some ground and aerial easements to help with the construction of the Windy Park Bridge, and then also the Whiskey Island Connector connecting Edgewater over to the Windy Park Bridge. So we worked with Norfolk Southern to acquire those easements, thus facilitating the construction of the bridge and the trail. And these are acquisitions that we say just kind of really helped improve access and connections within the park. So again, we worked with Norfolk Southern Railway and Garfield Park Reservation. This is in the Mill Creek Falls area. Mill Creek Falls is right in here. And we leased this property from Norfolk Southern, but it's a short-term lease, and it was a small area. So in this area here, we acquired an additional 3.4 acres, and we're able to extend the terms of the lease because it was a kind of more of a short-term lease. So again, protecting the views for that, the waterfall there, or the largest waterfall in Cuyahoga County. And the Skagilda property in North Royalton, this is just on Drake Road in Millstream Run Reservation. So you can see we didn't really have any good access along Drake. And there's a really nice wetland back here that our staff really couldn't get great access to. So this just picked up another 1.2 acres to improve that access. And then we've been, you know, working very closely with our community development corporations and our local land banks. And so both of these properties are results of that. In Bradley Woods, we picked up 3 additional parcels from North Olmsted's land bank. And then in Washington Reservation, we worked with Slavic Village Development and the Cuyahoga County Land Reutilization Corporation to acquire some additional acreage. So that's a partnership that we continue to work on, identifying properties that are close to our reservations or within connectors that we can pick up additional properties through that mechanism. This slide just highlights where we added additional acreage. So you can see we added acreage in 10 separate reservations, 12 different communities, and 2 counties being Cuyahoga and Medina. And then Cleveland Metro Parks is in 6 main watersheds. Rocky River watershed is our largest acreage, followed by Cuyahoga River watershed. So as I mentioned, just to kind of wrap up 2020, we surpassed our 24,000 acres. You can see this chart on the bottom kind of sums when we hit that 1,000 acre mark over the years. So it was in the early 2000s that we broached into the 20,000 acres. And since that time, we've grown by 4,000 acres to be at 24,000, you know, and looking forward to the next several years hitting that 25,000 mark. The map here on the left illustrates all the properties that we acquired in 2020. And it was the property that we acquired from Western Reserve Land Conservancy, the Goodrich property, which set us over that 24,000 acre mark. So 2020, you know, obviously was a challenging year. I mean, I don't think we would have envisioned ourselves wearing masks and eating in igloos, But it was a year that, yeah, I think everyone really came together and worked towards land preservation, and we recognized how important our parks were to our community members. And so we always just want to say a thank you to our internal staff and our external partners that really help us get there. So we've been working with our development department to establish a land protection fund. We actually just had a virtual event last week where we spoke to some donors about land preservation. And just yesterday, we received a thank you and a donation from one of those participants. And a lot of the money from the land protection fund also helped fund a couple of our acquisitions this year, some of the ones in Brecksville and elsewhere. So just a big thank you to development. They help us secure a number of grants just this year, over $2 million in grants, and then again, private donations as well. Our partners this year have been West Creek Conservancy. They added, you know, nearly 52 acres to West Creek. Western Reserve Land Conservancy, we added 48 acres to Brecksville. And then the Cuyahoga County Land Revitalization Corporation were able to expand Washington Reservation. And then our natural resources and planning and design departments are so important. We have to write, you know, grants to help us acquire these properties, and the data that they collect is so important. I mean, that's what sets our grants above other organizations, is that data. And then they also help us with, after we acquire the property, some of the grant source wants to see some restoration money. So they help us identify, you know, what restoration will make this property even better and how we can write that into our grant. And then with our GIS and planning team, we've been able to establish a land protection plan. We're working with them to kind of have this GIS tool where we can quickly turn on layers on and off that help us evaluate properties for acquisition. So just a big thank you to.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
The Cuyahoga County Land Utilization or Corp, have we done anything with them to date?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What property? Because that's almost all city property. City.
All of the ones.
Actually, it's not.
No, because okay. No, Bradley was one. And
yeah, so we, a number of years ago, we met with them and we compared our park boundaries with their land bank holdings.
Yes, I remember.
And there came up properties everywhere from Big Creek to Euclid Creek. Obviously, the city of Cleveland was larger. There's a lot around Washington Reservation, Garfield Park. So yeah, just this year, we acquired four properties in Washington Reservation through our cooperation with.
And were those raw properties, or were they profit? I'm sorry about that. Or were there properties that that had buildings on them?
So there were four properties that were just vacant, and then there was one property which had a home. Oh. And that's why we worked with Slavic Village Development. They actually held the property for a little while. The home was taken down, and then we acquired it.
Okay.
So generally, they're vacant, but there have been situations, you know, where there are homes, and then we kind of, again, work with our partners to help.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, we have quite a few. We have a running list of properties that we're working on with them. We have some in North Olmsted that are coming up. And so we just continue. We just continue to work with them to identify, and then we kind of wait patiently as they become available. And it's been a great partnership, and I think we'll see a lot more coming through that as well.
Terrific.
Yeah, and they put us in contact with other land, you know, so sometimes it's not like they hold it, but that's how we acquired the ones in North Olmsted too. They let us know that that had been passed to the city, and then we reached out to the city, and then we were able to acquire it.
Great network.
So just lastly, I want to touch on that stewardship component that we talked about. We have a new staff member this year, Nate Hoover, who's really helping us through this. I think as the pandemic ensued, we saw a lot of people, you know, being home more and expanding their backyards. So there are times we have to kind of institute our good neighbor policy and check in with adjacent landowners who maybe aren't aware that some of their actions do impact our parks. We see things like structures or landscaping, even something as simple as dumping their grass clippings or the leaves over the hillside can have an impact on the park. So we're working closely with our park operations park managers to identify where these encroachments are, and then ultimately resolution to kind of pull back their actions so that they're not encroaching on park property. Another point of our stewardship program is conservation easements. So, you know, sometimes it's a different conservation option as opposed to a fee acquisition where we can permanently limit the use of our land. So we hold nearly 500 acres of conservation easements across the park district. And part of this program is just periodically inspecting those properties to protect the easement. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people buy property and don't really understand the terms of that easement or even know it's there. So just continuing to work with landowners.
Have we given any conservation easements? In other words, acquired the conservation easements rights on a property, like in the last, I don't recall.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years since we've acquired a conservation easement with a landowner. I will say part of the West Creek Conservancy Fourth Lease Amendment, West Creek holds a number of conservation easements, so they assigned those conservation easements to us.
Yeah.
So we had a number of conservation easements that way this year. We also sometimes issue conservation easements back to organizations. So Western Reserve Land Conservancy, for example, when we partner with them, they often ask for a conservation easement back so that they can kind of make sure the land is protected in perpetuity too. But yeah, I think it's probably, I mean, the last one I can think of was in Millstream Run on Ridge Road, where we have kind of that connection along the east branch of the Rocky River. We have a number of conservation easements in that area that we've worked on. And then this one is actually fairly recent too. This is north of Bradley Woods Reservation. A developer was developing this portion of the property on Bradley Road, and they donated this conservation easement to us as an area that was like more sensitive and wouldn't be really available for development. So that probably actually is the most recent one we've had.
And was that a wetland?
Yeah, I mean, it's Bradley Woods Reservation, so like kind of that swampy wet woods. Yeah. And then lastly, deed restrictions. So the map here to your right is kind of our historical land maps. And you can see, like this, for example, was, you know, an entire block of property, and we purchased what was in green. And so this is Hawthorne Parkway and South Sugar Land Reservation. So often when we would do this, where we purchased this and the owner would retain this piece, we would put limits on the adjacent property because we really want Hawthorne Parkway to feel like a parkway. So we may limit the amount of driveways or access from that property. And then we might have setbacks for where a structure can be, or limits on use. So it has to be residential, or, you know, we might limit no billboards or electrical poles, that type of thing. So we do have these types of restrictions across the park district. So we continue just to monitor development adjacent to our parks and alert both owners and the municipalities when we have, you know, restrictions that might conflict with their proposed plans. So that is all I have for you. I don't know if anyone has any questions. I'd be happy to take them.
Nice job.
It's thorough.
Yeah, that's amazing. Nice job, everybody.
Just to echo the comments of the board, and I mean, you know, through the team, there's so many things that Stephanie glossed over, the hard work that it takes to acquire some of these properties. And the one in particular in Millstream was a love of labor, and there was a lot of carrying of the water to get that particular property closed out, and to it includes so many other, you know, great opportunities. And as I've stated before, the community wins when we're able to conserve these properties for the generations that will come after us. So I just want to say again, thank you to Kyle and Stephanie and Isaac and now Nathan that's with us, and our entire GIS team, and Sean, Joe, everybody's involved in this. So thank you so much. That was Info item, there is no executive session, and we will see you in April.
Very good.
Move to adjourn.
Move to adjourn the meeting.
Second.
All in favor?
Favor, aye.
Aye. Thank you, guys.
Bill. So, if you have a moment, I'd love.